welcome to Information Week Live for the week of May 24th, 2015. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, and we're going to have a great show today. We've got a roundtable discussion, a fairly small roundtable in this case, but a roundtable discussion. But I tell you what, if the conversation that we were having just before the show started is any indication, it's going to be a lively discussion. Now, speaking of lively discussions, there's also a lively discussion available on informationweek.com. Now, to join that particular discussion, this live text chat, all you have to do is type your comment, question, pithy observation, or just statement to the universe in the box labeled your post. Then be sure to click that big red post button under the box. Well, let's get our conversation here on the air started. I'm joined by Information Week Editorial Director Susan Nunziata. Susan, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. It's great to be here.
And by Executive Editor for Community and IT Life, Dave Wagner. Dave, as always, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. Happy to be here.
Now, we were talking about some of the stories that have caught our eye this week, and we're talking about one that I want to dive right into because I think it hits on a lot of different things. Our colleague Sarah Peters, who's a senior editor over at Dark Reading, wrote a piece this week on a UN report that says encryption backdoors violate human rights. And I think that's fascinating because you have on the other side of things government leaders, famously the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, who said that essentially nothing that we do in terms of electronic communications should be hidden, that there should be a backdoor in absolutely everything. So what do you folks think? Susan, I'm going to turn to you first. I know where Dave's going to come down on this, but what do you think about this whole notion of a mandatory backdoor in communications?
I live in the People's Republic of Berkeley, Kurt. So I think you can guess where my progressive liberal bent might fall on this one. I find the concept that so-called openness should be mandatory and that governments have the right to peek into anything in our lives without due process to be simply deplorable. So my feeling is that I happen to side with the UN on this one and would put civil liberties pretty high on my list of priorities. So I'm agreeing that privacy is an essential human right.
Well, Dave, how about you? Are you going to be the contrary voice here, or are you agreeing with Susan? And I'll give you a heads up now. This is also pretty much my take on the subject.
Right. Well, and you know what? It is my take, too, except I have one caveat here. What I think is true is that the government does, with a warrant, have a right to tap my phone. It does have a right with warrants to search my house. I don't necessarily have a problem with the creation of a back door, which is created to be used with a warrant, with appropriate powers, the way any other search is conducted. So a back door that would allow a government to search my email or encrypted data with a warrant doesn't bother me. The problem,
but that's like giving them
the key to
your back door. You don't have to give
the government
a key to your house.
Go through my back door with a warrant. So the issue at hand, this is the problem, is that we have right now a system that is allowing the government to do things without a warrant, and that's a problem. What's going on is the NSA's massive collection of data, the secret courts that have been set up by the Patriot Act, all of this, that is the problem. If there were honest-to-goodness checks on government power and the government honestly followed those rules, I have no problem with the idea that with a warrant they should be able to crack my encryption. The problem is we know in reality, and so does the UN, that every government, whether it's the United States government or insert evil empire government here, North Korea or whoever, every government is trying to secure as much power as possible while being limited by the population. So in practice, I'm against the back door. In theory, I think it makes some sense.
Well, now, here's one of my problems. It's not so much that the government can tap communications with a warrant. It's that by the nature of encryption, if you create a back door, you have just broken the encryption. And
right.
Therefore, the idea of a back door that only the government can come through is ridiculous on its face. Either encryption works or it doesn't. And I guarantee, I would bet a month's salary or more that if a backdoor were created and we were all told only the government can come through it, within, I'll give myself a big window, 60 days. I actually think it's much less than that. But within 60 days, we would see the first demonstration of an exploit against that back door.
Absolutely. But you know, we see that with encryption, period. Anybody says, I have an encryption that can't be defeated, or I have an encryption that is going to require years to defeat, the first thing that happens is an army of hackers says, oh, I can beat that faster.
Well,
exactly, and our government can't even keep IRS information secure, so we're going to trust them with back doors into our personal encrypted information? Does not work in reality at all.
Well, the problem is the government has never successfully dealt with technology except when it comes to protecting their own top secret interests. And even then, they probably fail at times and we don't even hear about it. But the truth is that the concept that a government has the right to look into your private data if you have been indicted or there's a reason to create a search warrant, there's nothing wrong with that to me in my mind. And so I think that the UN saying that it's a human rights violation is just a little much. What it becomes is the practice as it is used is a human rights violation. The government being able allowed to see my data under a warrant is not.
Being allowed to see your data under a warrant, correct, by requesting that you turn over the keys to whatever encryption you're using, just like they would require a warrant and require you to open your mouth to give them a DNA sample, for example, that's a different thing from having back doors installed for everybody, regardless of their activity. It's sort of like saying, I'll let the government cut a hole in my floor so that they can climb in case they need to execute a search warrant on my house. You know?
Right.
It makes no sense.
Well, but let's look at the analogy the opposite way, which is that if I don't want my house searched and I say no, even though the government has a warrant, they knock my door down. If I say I'm not giving you my encryption keys, there's no equivalent to knocking the door down, except probably the NSA really has one they're not telling us about. But there's no equivalent to knocking the door down other than taking years to crack that encryption.
Well,
and
I'm think
actually okay with that. Because
I think realistically, it's no longer years.
Fair enough.
Pretty most encryption schemes can be brute forced with enough computing hardware, and I think we can just stipulate that somewhere out in the desert of Utah, there exists enough computing hardware to break pretty much any encryption out there if the information is deemed valuable enough. And that's the real question. Interestingly enough, just on a historical side note, in the Wall Street Journal today, there is an advertisement from an auction house. One of the original Enigma machines is up for auction. And they're talking about what a fine, high-quality specimen this is with apparently a few extra cost options thrown in. I figured that all of them came with certain standard things, but evidently not. And we have what was at the time the world's most powerful encryption system. Now, a few decades later, up for auction for collectors of historical curiosities. And I think that there's probably some sort of grand lesson in that somewhere. I would love to turn our attention, though. We've been talking about encryption, and one of the places that people feel their communication is more secure is in the encrypted communication from their smartphones. I mean, cell phone communications are supposed to be, to a certain level, encrypted by their nature. And we had several stories this week on the number of smartphones out there and new developments in the smartphone operating system. Kelly Sheridan, our associate editor, had a piece in which she said Android reaches a billion users. And so I guess the question that I'd like to introduce next for our discussion is, are there dangers in having so many communications devices all using the same operating system? Although I will accept arguments that Android is anything but a single operating system here. Dave, I know you use some flavor of Android. What do you think?
I'm not all that worried about that. Maybe I should be. I'm willing to say that I am undereducated. But my general feeling is that before the cellular phone was invented, we all used the same operating system for a landline phone, at least within countries. And I don't think that was necessarily a problem. And I know it changes when you go to software, you go to cellular. I get that. But what you do gain in risk, and you do gain some risk, you also get back in simplicity. If Android were one flavor, and we, I think, can all stipulate to the fact that it's not, if Android were one flavor, it would also be one thing to defend in the same way that it's one thing to attack. So I'm not necessarily bothered by that. I think there is a real simplicity into everybody being on the same system. I've been just amazed by the number of people who are willing to have an Apple phone and a Windows desktop and an Android, you know, tablet, and I know people who do that, and I don't understand how they function that way. I'm willing to have a certain amount of simplicity across files, across communication systems, even if that does increase my risk.
Well, Susan, I'm not sure that you have launched out in the direction of Android these days. What is your take on this? Is the simplicity of a single operating system for everyone enough to outweigh the size of the target that that user base paints on the vulnerabilities that inevitably exist in these operating systems?
Well, I think it's just a matter of supply and demand. You know, it's not something we really have control over. I'm sort of, you know, trapped in the Apple iOS Mac ecosystem for those very same reasons of simplicity. I'm honestly technologically lazy when it comes to having to get things done on a day-to-day basis. So I'm comfortable with that. But I think the concept that ubiquity increases risk is not a new concept for us, right? We saw that with Windows operating systems versus Apple Mac OS. And for a long time, there was this mythology around Mac OS that it was inherently somehow more secure than Windows because it got hacked less, when the reality is just that Windows was a bigger target and therefore more attractive with a better return on investment for anyone who wanted to spend their time hacking it. So I think, you know, the same forces are at play here. And as we continue to use our smartphones for everything from banking to payments to sharing our health information, that bullseye is just going to grow. So the more people in an operating system and in an ecosystem around that, the more risk. But unfortunately, I don't like it, but I suspect it's unavoidable. It's just a natural consequence of market domination.
Right. And real interesting part about that is when the Internet of Things arrives, right, and we're no longer talking about 1 billion devices owned by people, but we're talking about 200 billion or as many as 370 billion as predicted by Gartner devices that are all going to be using, you know, just a couple of different operating systems and communications protocols. I'm not nearly worried about that 1 billion phones as I am about the, you know, the 370 billion coffee makers. You know.
Well, I'm wondering whether at that point the strategy moves away from the analogy that we've used for a long time of don't be the low-hanging fruit to one that's more like try to make sure you're at the center of the bait ball.
Yes.
Because
it's
always the outermost sardine that gets picked off first.
Right. Yeah, it is a schooling mentality at that point. You're protected mostly by the fact that they can't get every one of you.
Well, one of the other things that we talked about this week on the pages of Information Week was the notion of predictive analytics. I know I had a piece that reported on some results out of England where a team of researchers had used data and found that if they could get cell phone or smartphone data and correlate it with things like how many of those smartphones were touching the internet and how many were using Twitter and some other things, they could get a very accurate estimate of crowd sizes based solely on smartphone activity in an area. And we had some other notions of predictive analytics based on information that is, if not publicly available, at least readily available, and the application of some big data analytical techniques. Do you think that we are getting closer to the world of Minority Report, where we can predict what large crowds of people are going to do? Dave, I know this is the sort of thing that you're pretty interested in. Where's your take? I mean, are we getting to the point where the world of Asimov's Foundation trilogy comes closer to being true, where you can make predictions about large masses of people based on what they're doing right now?
Right. Well, I'll tell you, another piece of that puzzle dropped into place when we covered it this week, too. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon invented a device that can accurately read somebody's iris from 40 feet away, and if that iris is in the database, identify who that person is. So that is another step to the minority report issue, right? Because it's one thing to say, well, this is a hostile crowd. There are a lot of people here. There's another to say, this influencer has entered the crowd. This is a person who is a known, terrorist. This is a person who's a known rabble rouser. And because we've seen that person's iris, we know the chances go up. Or just, this person bought jeans last week and they have the same iris. There's that scene in Minority Report where Tom Cruise walks in and they say, I hope you enjoyed those khakis you bought last week, right? The iris is another way to do that. So not only predictive analytics, but the ability to track biometrically the population. So combined, I think that creates a very scary, almost worse, by the way, than the backdoor encryption we were talking about before, as a way for the government to passively scan citizens and decide what they're doing and arrest them before they ever do anything wrong. That's a frightening thing to me.
Now, Susan, living as you do in the People's Republic of Berkeley, you can't possibly see anything wrong with this sort of public safety activity on behalf of our government officials.
Well, Kurt, I edited your piece yesterday on estimating crowd size, and basically couldn't sleep last night being so concerned about the implications there. So needless to say, as with the backdoor encryption concept, the iris scanning and the monitoring of our cell phone and Twitter data to assess crowd size or crowd activities, while I get that these things are attractive and have implications, not just for government, but for retailers and those who create sporting events and all sorts of other wonderful things, it gives me the heebie-jeebies overall. I find the idea really creepy. And on a government scale, all of it leads to the concept that millions and millions of us are presumed guilty until proven innocent instead of the other way around. So I feel that just as our security theater at airport checkpoints has reached a level of the absurd, so too do these concepts start to get into the level of absurdity when it comes to the idea of everyone's irises being on some kind of database, et cetera. That said, I think it's a boulder rolling down a hill. I don't think there's much that's going to stop it, and I think it will feed dystopian literature for many, many years to come.
Sorry, Kurt, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's interesting, Dave, that you brought up the scene in Minority Report when they were asking Tom Cruise about the khakis that he had bought, because that's precisely the scenario that we've heard about at SAP's Sapphire the past two or three years, using the analytical power of their in-memory databases to give instant analysis at the point of contact with a customer. And they were using Burberry as an example of a company that was actually doing this in some of their stores. Now, to me, the interesting part of that is that the head of retail for Burberry is now the head of retail for Apple.
Yes.
So I think we can presume that the geniuses are about to start seeming a whole lot smarter when we walk into one of their stores.
And Apple just announced big changes to its retail stores and promised more coming. So I think we can kind of take a stab at what some of that coming might be.
Well, to me, the whole notion, too, is that it's important for us to be doing the predictive analytics, and something that I have tended to refer to as prescriptive analytics, where the system doesn't simply tell you what it thinks is going to happen next, but suggests what you should do as an organization or an individual to have an influence on the future. And I think that's where things start to get awfully murky in terms of the intersection of technology and ethics, although I'm willing to believe that I'm part of the tinfoil hat crew on this one.
Well, part of the problem is that every one of these technologies you can come up with a legitimate use for. So take the determining the size of a crowd via phone analytics. We'll reverse that from a riot, and let's say instead it's refugees from a natural disaster or from a war, and you have tens of thousands of people running away from something, and you need to get them assistance. You need to get them clothes and food. Well, we know NGOs have constantly struggled after natural disasters or during wars to get the right amount of supplies to a place. We also know that the developing world, where a lot of these refugee situations are taking place, have increasing cell phone penetration. So we can, in fact, imagine NGOs being given better and better data to do their wonderful job with the exact same thing that a government could use to do something nefarious. And the same can be said for all these technologies. And you know, it's a tool, and it's a tool that it depends on whose hands it's in as to whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
No question. Well, now, speaking of legitimate uses and the use to which we can put all of this, Dave, you had an interesting article this week on some prediction going on based on smartphone use and what it could mean to one's college career. Help us out with understanding what the good folks up at Dartmouth, I believe it was, have figured out about this correlation.
Dartmouth is doing, I think, a very cool thing. They have been working, their computer science research folks have been working with their student life department for quite a while to develop tools. A few years ago, they developed a tool that would help predict mental health issues among their students before they became emergent and potentially life-threatening, which was a fantastic tool. And this year, they've come up with a tool that can predict your GPA to within 0.17 points based solely on your smartphone's behavior. So no inputs on your own required. And what they've done is they have, Dartmouth is in a tiny town of Hanover, and so it's relatively easy to map out all of the Wi-Fi hotspots and various other things within a city to know, hey, this is a fraternity house, this is a sorority house, this is a coffee shop, this is the library. To track you, you you give permission through the app to track your behavior through the day. And what it does then is it makes presumptions about your behavior. You spent 3 hours in the library, chances are you were studying for some percentage of that. You spent 8 hours in your room not moving at all with the phone off, chances are you were sleeping. You spent 3 hours on a Saturday night in a sorority house, you were probably having some fun at the party. So they collect all this data, make these assumptions, and then they can predict based on existing understanding of how one succeeds in college. They can guess your GPA without any knowledge of your IQ, your SATs, your previous grades, anything like that. And then the best part about it is they can give you prescriptive advice. Hey, you know, last week was a lot of fun. You had some really great time at the party, but maybe it's time to chill out and study a little more this week. And so they can monitor your stress, they can monitor your sleep, your health, and they do a really good job of keeping people on track. And they only tested this with 30 students, but they found that the 30 students that used this, even the lower performers, were not getting off track as easily as they would have been without such a device to keep them going.
Well, I do think that's interesting because I know going back to my own college career, it's possible that someone could have looked at the amount of time I spent on a particular bar stool and tried to figure out the correlation with my GPA for that term. But I don't know that I'd say it was an absolute correlation. I, to be honest, my memory's a little foggy on that part.
Well, and it's a quantified life situation. It's not just the amount of time you spend in the bar. You might spend way more time in the bar than the next guy, but you also may spend way more time in the library. So it's adding up the whole of your life. And I think this has real implications in other places, including work. I think it's a little more frightening at work because it brings in a sort of big brother element to your boss. But we know through research that certain types of jobs require connections, right? So there are jobs that we want to see our workers circulating from desk to desk, connecting the dots, understanding how things are going. And there are other jobs where we want people, you know, more focused at their desk. And understanding the way we move through the day can really help us figure out how to do our jobs better. Alternately, it can mean that your boss says, hey, you're not spending enough time at your desk, sit down. and some of it is about a simple self-discipline reality. We all think we spend more time doing work and less time having fun, I think, than is true. And so one of the things is to have the data staring you in the face and say, look, this is what you've really been doing. You know, is this what you want? And if it is, keep going. And if it isn't, you know, here's how you can change.
Susan, what do you think? I mean, is this one of those things where you think that someone watching where your cell phone has been could make useful suggestions to you on how best to spend your time?
Oh, Lord, I am Gen X. What can I tell you? I was not helicopter parented. I grew up running the streets. I managed to make my way through college with a decent GPA while still going to the keggers and somehow made it through. And I've been able to have a career that's gone on longer than I'm ever going to admit publicly. Without needing these things. I'm not a believer in Fitbits. I'm not a believer in any of that stuff. I personally don't have any interest in having any of these tools involved in my life. However, I'm willing to institute them for the editorial team at Information Week so you guys can test them out and let me know how you like using them. I was thinking of maybe adding a little electrical shock, like, Kurt, sit at your desk and write, or Dave.
all mine would say is that I sat on the couch, and then I got up and got to the refrigerator, and I went back and sat on the couch. That's the glory of working from home.
And stop watching those cat videos.
Well, and, you know, the cat video joke is funny, but it's also a legitimate sort of way, because we know that 10 years ago, and even less in some enterprises were spending a huge amount of time watching our internet usage, right? Because A, they didn't want to get rid of resources, and B, they didn't want you fooling around. And some enterprises still block YouTube or whatever, right? Well, you know, in recent years, though, employees have fought back and said, look, you know, a 5-minute break here or there doesn't matter. We need it to recharge, and enterprises have been relenting on that. So a smart enterprise wouldn't use this to say get back to work. It would say this. It would use this to say start talking to your colleagues more. Because we know that's how innovation happens, and we know how, that's how problems get solved. And so, you know, just like all the other tools we've been talking about, the good tool is going to be how do we improve collaboration, not how do we force people to work harder.
Wait, you mean I'm supposed to talk to you folks when we're not on the radio?
That's your call. I wouldn't do it with me. I think I'd do it with some of our other colleagues.
Well, nobody wants to talk to Dave, so.
Right. Well, yeah, they don't want to hear me on the radio either. Sorry, guys.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time here, but I wanted to go around the virtual table and find out what's coming up in the next week. Susan, you have the big view of what's going to be going on at Information Week. What should we all be looking for in the coming week as we begin June and, for me, begin hurricane season?
Fun times. Well, to segue out of the college discussion we were just having, I will warn everyone to look out for a piece that's coming up on Sunday about internships. Now, as I just said, I was a Gen Xer, so my internship involved being grateful that I was even considered to be allowed in the door and was lucky to get any college credits. So if that was your experience, then this upcoming piece from our Kelly Sheridan will probably depress you because internships are not what they used to be. So look out for that on Sunday. And then we have our usual array of upcoming pieces that will be looking at things like how to get yourself a raise and how to best position yourself in your organization to request a raise and make your case, especially if you work in IT, for how you prove value to the business. So that's some of the things we'll be looking at next week.
Outstanding. And for all of your insight on various things, how can people keep up with you on the various social media sites? Is something happening on the Tweety Pipe the best way to find you?
That is the best way. So I do comment on our at Information Week Twitter feed as well as my own, which is at Susan Nunziata.
Outstanding. Well, we should all be following you and make sure we have you flagged for special consideration. Now, speaking of special consideration, Dave, what should we be especially considering for our reading in the coming week?
Yeah, well, we got a little bit of fun in honor of summer starting this week with Memorial Day. I'm working right now, and it should be up for the weekend, a list of the hot video game releases for the summer, for those days where it's a little too hot to go outside. And I'm also working for next week some summer IT reading lists. Kelly Sheridan's working on one. I'm working on another one, IT reading for the summer for CIOs, and also just a fun beach read piece as well for those times when you go on vacation. And, of course, we'll have more career news and other slightly chewier material as well to help your work week.
Well, I've got to go off and look up this strange word you use, this vacation thing. But while I do that, is there a way that people can keep up with you on social media? How are you getting the word out on a moment-by-moment basis?
At Geekend Dave. Geekend is like weekend with a G, as I say to my children who are learning to read. At Geekend Dave on Twitter. And InformationWeek.com, and I also contribute to AllAnalytics.com.
We will look forward to reading your wit, wisdom, and insight in all of those places. Now, For me, in the coming week, I'm going to be looking at some more Internet of Things topics, going to be diving into some more development issues. I have another product evaluation sitting in the queue. Lots going on, and as always, people can follow me and get insight on what's going on with my little corner of the world at Twitter at KG4GWA. Now, next week, we are also planning on the return of Interop Radio. Interop Radio will be kicking off its post-event phase starting Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern. Please look for the URL in my Twitter feed. That's going to be hosted over at Blog Talk Radio. Then on Wednesday at 3 p.m., we'll have IT Life Radio. Dave, real quickly, what's going to be going on at IT Life Radio?
Yeah, we have the CEO of BetterWorks, and we're going to be talking about how to toss out the annual review, which I don't think anybody likes, and replace it with something far more effective.
Ooh, that does sound like a great show. We'll all be there. Again, that's Wednesday, 3 p.m., and be sure to join us again right here next Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern for another episode of Information Week Live. Well, for Dave Wagner, Susan Nunziata, and everyone at Information Week, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. Hey, we'll see you next time.